12. Cultures of Authority and Cultures of Dissent. Iran in the 1960s and 1970s witnessed an era of cultural fluorescence, a period remarkable for artistic creativity, the rise of new talent, and greater international exposure, but also greater state sponsorship. Expressions of artistic and intellectual dissent, often transmitted through a language of symbols, emerged in cinema, poetry, and popular music. Such efforts were tolerated by the state, and even patronized by the state-controlled media and by governmental and semi-governmental cultural institutions. They were treated as outlets for intellectual dissent and deemed necessary as cultural safety valves. The period also witnessed a new drive for glorification of Pahlavi rule and for the Shah's vision of imperial greatness. Curiously, the two currents, cultural subversion, operating underneath a calm surface, and glorification of the monarchic cult, lived side by side and even nurtured each other. As the author and cultural critic Jalal Alle Ahmad once commented, the state successfully managed to bring all intellectual dissidents into its cultural stable. This complex dialogue bore important consequences during and after the 1979 revolution. Sunlight of the Aryans. In April 1965, when the Shah closely escaped another assassination attempt by a soldier of his royal guards in the Marmar Palace, he became even more convinced that he was providentially protected. A small cell of intellectuals with Maoist leanings had masterminded the assassination attempt. They were tried and sentenced to death, but later pardoned. Perhaps it was not a coincidence that in the same year the Shah also assumed the title of Aryamer, or Sunlight of the Aryans. The Majlis bestowed it on him, no doubt at his own instigation. Coined by a professor of ancient Iranian studies in Tehran University, the title was a nod to the Persian notion of royal glory, far, and in recognition of all the benefits the Shah had offered to the Aryan nation of Iran, so it was declared, through the revolution of the Shah and the people, which was accomplished under his aegis. The magnitude of imperial self-glorification became more evident 2 years later, when in 1967, after 26 years on the throne, the Shah decided to officially celebrate his coronation and that of Queen Farah in an elaborate ceremony. Driving through glittering decorations of the Tehran streets in a carriage reminiscent of the British royal household, the Shah and the Queen arrived at the Golestan Palace. There, in full royal regalia and with much heavier accoutrements than his father's coronation outfit, he first placed on his own head the Pahlavi crown and held the royal scepter. He then placed a newly made crown, designed by the New York jeweler Harry Winston, on the head of his queen. Despite its fairy tale extravagance, the event was not treated as a farce, at least not by most Iranians, who probably enjoyed watching the fanfare on television and were content to see their Shah having his moment in the sun. Yet his thirst for celebrations grew, almost addictively, to fantastic dimensions, when in 1971 the Shah celebrated 2,500 years of the Iranian monarchy in a more extravagant style. It was an event aimed, even more than the coronation, to place the Pahlavi monarchy and the reign of the Shah in particular within an imperial narrative that stretched back to the ancient Achaemenid Empire. The idea, first proposed by European Iranists in the 1950s, was escalated in scale by the mid-1960s to a huge event of loftier consequence. It was to commemorate not merely the founding of the Persian Empire, presumably calculated from the death of Cyrus in 530 BC rather than the conquest of Babylon in 539 BC, but also the very continuity of Iranian imperial history that had culminated in the Pahlavi era and the return of Iran's might and glory. The subtext was unmistakable. Iran's immortality, as the propaganda for celebrations reminded many foreign guests, in reality meant to script the image of a prophet king, a latter-day Cyrus, into an Iranian meta-history. It was not without reason, therefore, that at the beginning of the commemoration ceremonies, the Sunlight of the Aryans stood before Cyrus's mausoleum in Pazargad, near Persepolis, in Fars province, and as an homage to the founder of the Persian Empire, solemnly declared, "Cyrus the Great, rest in peace, we are awake." Kurash-e-Bazarg, Asude bihab, ma bidarim. These were words that a generation would be destined to sound so sobering and yet ironic, given the velocity of the revolutionary process that destroyed the Pahlavi regime and seemingly forever ended monarchy in Iran less than a decade later. The festivities left in many minds, Iranian and foreign, a curious impression. It became the staple of many reports about contemporary Iran to view the extravagance and the ludicrous expenses lavished on foreign invitees as demonstration of the excesses that eventually brought down the Pahlavi regime. In October 1971, some 600 foreign royals, heads of state and other dignitaries and their entourages were brought to Shiraz to be housed on a 160-acre luxurious tent city that had been set up on the reforested plain of Marvdasht, opposite the colossal ruins of Persepolis. They dined in a marquee for the banquet that was 200 feet long and served on Limoges dinnerware manufactured for the occasion, sat around opulent tables decorated with 50 roasted peacocks with their tail feathers set in foie gras, ate Caspian golden caviar and other delicacies catered by Maxime's and flown in from Paris, and drank such rare wines as a 1945 Chateau Lafite Rothschild. A visual show with fireworks followed the nearly 6 hours of formal dinner, accompanied by Yanis Xenakis's musical piece Persepolis that had been commissioned for the evening. It all went down in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most lavish official banquet in modern times, a very dubious distinction for the host country, given the enormous cost and breezy arrogance displayed by host and guests alike. The next day, below the stairway of Persepolis, foreign guests witnessed a parade through the ages of Iranian imperial armies, from Achaemenid to Pahlavid, with performers in colourful period costumes, complete with gear and military equipment. Even a full-scale model of a navy vessel and a siege tower from the Achaemenid period were rolled through, all choreographed no less spectacularly than a Hollywood epic, and with taste and expertise drawn from Hollywood studios. Yet, from nearly all these festivities, even the march of colourful imperial armies, the Iranian general public was excluded, as if the events were merely to impress foreign guests and satisfy an outsized royal ego that had long been injured by a sense of inferiority. The Shah had to prove that he was no less majestic than his European counterparts. There were also security issues and fear of popular protests or armed attacks on the Shah and his guests. Queen Elizabeth and President Richard Nixon both declined their invitations, apparently for security concerns, dispatching others instead. It is small wonder that as many as 250 red Mercedes-Benz limousines were assigned to transport guests through the massive security that radiated beyond Persepolis to cover nearly all of the country. In a carefully designed operation, the SAVAK rounded up hundreds of political dissidents, blocked roads, monitored airports, and cordoned off neighbourhoods. Of at least $21 million spent on the event, no doubt the most enduring aspect of it was the commemorative monument, Shahyad Aryamer, built at Tehran's gateway in a novel style that incorporated Persian architectural traditions. Designed by Hossein Amanat, born 1941, a graduate from Tehran University, the vast square and monument at its centre displays Iran's cultural continuity, while at the same time conveying a message of revival. The four massive columns rising to make the two complementing arches of the Sasanian and Islamic epochs are intertwined in an hyperbolic latticework of stone and mosaic beneath an observation tower reminiscent of the Tagrel Tower of the Seljugid era. A 148-foot concrete structure encased in crafted blocks of white stone from Joshakan marble, with its complex geometry, modernist contours, and advanced construction techniques, espoused not only a conceptual departure, but also an optimistic sense of permanency beyond its immediate function. In the following decades, Shahyad endured the test of time throughout the fiercely anti-monarchical revolution of 1979, hosting under its arch some of the most memorable rallies, which were attended by millions carrying revolutionary banners. Renamed Barj-e-Azadi, Freedom Tower, in the aftermath of the revolution, in the following decades it transcended both its monarchical and revolutionary past to become perhaps Iran's most popular icon. No longer a state symbol, it was adopted by most Iranians as a national emblem, and as late as June 2009, as a memorial site for the Green Movement's mass rallies. In the following years, the Shah was ever more convinced of his prophetic mission and ready to drag Iran across the threshold into his great civilization. In February 1971, his court minister, Asadullah Alam, recorded in his secret diary a private conversation with that Shah. His Majesty mentioned strange things about his belief in divine support for him. "I have noticed that whoever opposed me, he has been eliminated, whether domestic or foreign." He gave the example of Kennedy brothers, the US president and two of his brothers, who were senators, and disliked the Shah. John Kennedy was assassinated, Robert, the senator, was assassinated, and the last of them, Edward, because of a strange affair over the death of a girl, was scandalized, and now his star is fading. Nasser, the Egyptian president, was also eliminated. Khrushchev, the Soviet premier, who also disapproved of His Majesty, was eliminated. In Iran, too, whoever opposed the Shah was deposed, for example, Mossadegh, and to some extent Ghavam al-Sultaneh. Razmarah, I am sure, held ominous designs for the Shah, and he, too, was assassinated. Mansour, who was an obvious American puppet, a man of unbridled ambitions, was also assassinated. Also well evident from the pages of Alam's secret diaries and the Shah's own public statements, for him, Iran increasingly turned into a utopian object to be desired, a mechanical contraption to be assembled, and an edifice to be embellished rather than a complex society, often in disarray, deprived of a voice, and deeply sceptical of his enterprise. If the best of intentions were to be assigned to him, the Shah demanded obedience and gratitude in exchange for an imagined fairy tale land that he believed was within his grasp. However, self-aggrandizement, coupled by a profound conspiratorial perspective in international and domestic politics, misplaced pride, and overconfidence in his judgment, blurred the royal's vision and prevented him from seeing trouble on the horizon. Virtually in every international event of consequence, the Shah saw the hidden hands of the great powers. From the Vietnam War to the Arab-Israeli conflict, to political upheavals in neighboring Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, he saw British or American or Soviet covert involvement. Domestically, too, he attributed any criticism of his policies or any independent trend to some behind-the-curtain foreign force, a reflection perhaps of his own insecurities. Nor did the Shah sense the climate of cynicism and indifference that gradually set in during the last decade of his reign, despite efforts to rein in or whip out forces of opposition. State sponsorship and cultural revival. By the middle of the 1960s, cultural patronage came to occupy a greater place in the Pahlavi search for imperial legitimacy and for appeal to a larger spectrum of Iranian population. Empress Farah and her coterie were instrumental in projecting a softer, more refined image of the Pahlavi state through media, music, architecture, literature, and visual arts. Dissident intellectuals and artists of earlier years, and potential dissidents among the younger middle classes, found the more relaxed cultural climate appealing. So long as the boundaries of political dissent were not crossed, artists and intellectuals could explore new, even implicitly subversive themes through television production, cinema, theatre, painting, and music. Though not completely free of harassment by the Savak, vast numbers found employment in the well-funded state media and cultural institutions. Farah Pahlavi's frequent travel to remote towns and villages of Iran also presented a new image of a caring queen, willing to learn about the country and help improve the lot of ordinary folks. The shift in cultural policy relied on tangible changes in Iranian society. Beyond the circles of power, Iranian society of the 1960s and 1970s underwent socio-cultural and demographic integration, which in turn revealed new socio-cultural demands. Although regional identities, ethnicity, religion, and class remained indelible parts of the landscape, public education, growth of a national market, and growth of media and entertainment boosted a greater sense of homogeneity. Public media, particularly radio and television, though completely under government control, were able to patronize Iranian art, music, and cinema that contrasted with the positivist westernizing obsessions of earlier decades. Some members of the clergy, and their followers, avoided the new media on the grounds that it disseminates deviant pleasures such as music. But most Iranians welcomed radio and television, and increasingly foreign and domestic motion pictures. By the 1960s, the introduction of battery-powered transistor radio sets and the expansion of the provincial radio broadcasting network increased audiences in towns and villages. Television, too, quickly replaced traditional storytelling in the coffee houses. The prominent display of a television set installed high up on a makeshift shelf on the wall of the neighborhood coffee houses, with patrons watching a low-budget Hollywood production, symbolized the state's new means of dominating the public at the expense of local voices and local dialects. An earlier example of the state's patronage of high-quality programming with the aim of offering a more sophisticated take on Persian musical heritage that was more palatable to the middle classes was the celebrated Gulhar, Flowers, program, produced by Radio Iran. Started in the mid-1950s, it was a natural outcome of earlier efforts by Ali Naghi Waziri, 1887 to 1979, and his Music Academy, established in 1923. In its mix of orchestral, vocal, and solo performances, Gulhar interspersed Western instruments such as piano, violin, and clarinet, with Persian tar, ney, reed pipe, tunbak, and santur, Persian dulcimer, to produce an elegant Persianized music loyal to the Radif system, but culturally confident enough to employ Western composition and orchestration with a romantic undertone, all while preserving Persian taste and texture. This was a genre greatly appealing to Iran's bourgeois sensibilities. Waziri was highly influential in this reincarnation of Persian music. Born to a father who was a Cossack officer and a celebrated feminist mother, Bibi Khanum Astarabadi, 1859-1921. Young Waziri, a German-educated military officer, was a product of the constitutional era and no doubt deeply influenced by the modernizing trends of that period. He established the first Academy of Music in 1924 and soon after Iran's first national orchestra, and he was among the first to commit Persian music to Western notation. In his musical academy, he taught composition, orchestration, and theory, as well as training some of the best musical talents of the generation, and himself composing new pieces for Persian instruments and developing new performing techniques for tar. Although occasionally criticized for trying to discipline the probably undisciplinable Persian quarter tone, Rob-e Parde, Waziri's contributions were crucial not only for the development of technique and for adapting the Radif to orchestral demands, but also for presenting Persian classical music as a respectable tradition, on par with Western tradition, and for including music in the school curriculum. The Gulhar program was the brainchild of Davud Pirnia, descendant of an important Qajar family of the cultural elite, who also attracted descendants of other cultural families to the program, as well as new talents. Among them was Abul Hasan Sabah, 1902-1957, an influential composer and music teacher who belonged to a family of poets and painters from Kashan, whose origin went back to the 18th century. He was a master violinist in the Persian style and a composer for the Persian Radif. His students mastered Persian style and dominated the musical stage. Ghulam Hossein Banan, 1911-1986, a vocalist of great ingenuity, also came from a Qajar family. Of the latter group, Murtaza Mahjoubi, 1900-1965, a piano virtuoso with his own distinct Persian style, demonstrated how European instruments could be employed in a completely different genre. Marzieh, 1924-2010, a stage name for a young and talented female tasnif singer, with a powerful range and nuanced voice, was of humble origins. Singing old tasnifs of the Qajar era, she was a product of the Gulhar. The most influential, however, was Ruhollah Khaleki, 1906-1965, a gifted composer and musical director of the Gulhar Orchestra, who, as a student of Waziri and admirer of Sabah, emerged as the musical force behind Gulhar's success, and in his short life composed many memorable pieces in the 1950s and early 1960s. By all accounts, the Gulhar project rescued Persian music from the formulaic tedium and barren repetition to which it had fallen for decades. As early as 1944, during the Allied occupation of Iran, Khalegi had become well known for his composition of a patriotic song, "Ey Iran, Thou Iran," which was based on a folk song from Gilan, known as Zard Maliche, which means yellow sparrow. Performed in the Dashti mode, the playful melody was first picked up by Sabah, but later, in Khalegi's hand, turned into a vivid and moving piece. The lyrics by Hossein Golgolab, 1895-1984, reflected Iranians' injured sentiments under occupation, praising Iran as a bejeweled land and wellspring of human gifts, and wished it to endure forever, immune from evil designs. The patriotic song, first performed in a public concert by Banan in the same year, soon came to be adopted as Iran's true national anthem and a song of resistance, in clear defiance of the imperial Shahanshahi anthem commissioned by Reza Shah in 1933. As much as the official anthem glorified the Shah and the imperial power, "Ey Iran" highlighted the land and people of Iran, without any reference to the Shah or state. All through the Pahlavi era, and later under the Islamic Republic, "Ey Iran" reflected such dissenting sentiments. As late as 2009, during the Green Movement, Janbesh-e-Sabz, the youth would sing it, among other places, in street rallies and while riding Tehran's subway cars. The creation of the National Iranian Radio and Television, NIRT, in 1967, funded and controlled by the state, incorporated, almost coercively, not only the nationwide radio network that had been in operation since 1928 and other local radio stations under the state umbrella, but also the privately owned National Iranian Television, established in 1958 by the entrepreneur Habib Sabet, which chiefly served the capital with coverage of about 2 million viewers and limited domestic production, later expanded to Abadan. By 1971, NIRT rapidly increased its coverage several-fold, and by 1976, thanks to generous government funding, especially support from Queen Farah and under the energetic directorship of Reza Ghotbi, it offered complete nationwide radio coverage and nearly 70% television coverage, amounting to more than 20 million viewers. The significant growth of NIRT provided the Pahlavi state with a powerful monopoly to relay not only its overt political message, but also a subtle agenda of secular nationalism. Television sets became an essential household good, first for the affluent middle classes in larger cities, and soon in smaller towns and many villages, with a growing viewership from all ages. Domestically manufactured sets made television more affordable, and multi-channel broadcasts, including an international channel in English that in 1972 replaced the US Army broadcast of earlier years, and regional stations with folk music and some production in local dialects, helped expand the appeal of the new media to one of the most effective arms of the state. The growth of state media absorbed intellectuals and discontented university graduates with artistic and literary talents, and others with technical and media expertise, into a growing organization with an institutional culture different from the state bureaucracy. An effective means of diverting dissent into exciting yet politically benign activity, NIRT reserved relative independence in its production and internal policies so long as it paid effusive homage to the Shah. The state's monopoly on broadcasting nevertheless meant sketching a bright future for the nation in a sanitized narrative devoid of meaningful criticism. It also meant a barrage of pro-Pahlavi propaganda suffused with images of the beloved Aryamehr extemporizing, inaugurating, hobnobbing with world leaders, or promoting his liberating white revolution. From time to time, it also had to stage Savak-sponsored shows, or even allowing the public to witness trials of Marxist intellectuals in military tribunals. Yet beyond the propaganda function, NIRT also conveyed a message that inadvertently contrasted the regime's glossy narrative. Through serials, music, variety shows, and documentaries, television soon became the most influential media and a source of information and entertainment. Replacing imported American serials, Peyton Place was exceptionally popular, Iranian television audiences began to learn through domestic productions about their own country, its social problems, and its ordinary people and their subsistence struggles. Though sanitized and made politically harmless, often the comic serials of life in poor neighborhoods, housing problems, overcrowded rental quarters, struggling itinerant handymen, the changing face of villages as they were devoured by cities, increasing urban crime and problems of law and order, the pretentious irrelevance of the old elite and their xenophobia, fostered a certain level of social awareness. The miniseries Daijan Napoleon, Dear Uncle Napoleon, directed by Nasser Tagvay, was a highly successful production aired by NIRT in 1976. Based on a satirical novel by Iraj Pezesh Gzad, it narrated the coming of age of a young boy during the World War II Allied occupation of Iran. The central character, a retired Cossack officer, is the patriarch of a Qajar-esque extended family whose internal feuds shape the hilarious plot and many subplots. Dear Uncle's paranoid fears of British mischief and his imagined victories in bygone battles no doubt were a parody of the conspiratorial anxieties of the old elite. The cultural sponsorship of NIRT was complemented by other sources of patronage linked to Farah Pahlavi's cultural office. Persian music, modern painting, new museums, cultural centres, art festivals, cinema and theatre, children literature, and innovative television productions were among them. Her interest in architecture allowed for experimentations in modern style far subtler than the rude imported modernism of the 1960s, and with a Persian component. The art and architecture projects primarily monumentalized the Pahlavi era, albeit with more sophistication. Yet their effect on the outlook and training of artists, performers, filmmakers, and architects cannot be underestimated. A whole generation of artists, filmmakers, and actors who later became representative of Iran's independent cultural flourishing in the post-1979 era, first learned their trade in the Pahlavi institutions and with some form of state support. The Shiraz Arts Festival, Jashne Hanar, was one obvious example of injecting enthusiasm and interest within both the Western and the Iranian art communities. Initiated by a pioneering filmmaker, Farooq Ghaffari, 1921-2006, heir to another remarkable artistic family of the Qajar era, it was meant to be an artistic bridge between diverse traditions from Europe and the Americas to Japan and Southeast Asia. It was also a conscious effort to recapture authenticity in Persian music and performance arts and put them on stage unapologetically and away from the positivist anxieties of earlier decades. Established in 1967, the festival invited a long list of celebrities, ranging from Arthur Rubinstein, Ravi Shankar, and Yehudi Menuhin, to playwright August Wilson and theatre director Peter Brook. Their dazzling performances and avant-garde productions, interspersed with performances by Iranian master musicians such as Tar virtuoso Jalil Shahnaz, 1921-2013, and great Tubak percussionist Hossein Terani, 1912-1974. The candlelit performances, accompanied by the odes of Hafez recited on the very site of the poet's tomb, a Persianized temple of love designed in the 1930s by the French architect André Godard, in the midst of a Persian garden, offered a novel experience. After a decade, during which it was annually held and at great expense, the festival left behind a mixed legacy. Above all, it helped promote traditional Persian music, boosting its preservation and development for decades to come. It was here that the great vocalist Mohammad Reza Shajarian first found a live audience more eager and more demanding than that of his mainstream radio programs. With an amazing vocal range, musical texture, technical knowledge, and artistic consistency, he worked his way through the Shiraz Arts Festival to become one of the greatest artists Iran produced in the latter half of the 20th century. Parisa, Fatemeh Vaezi, another vocalist of quality and grace, who sang Persian Radif in the festival with the same ease as she did Qajar and early Pahlavi Tasnifs, was the representative of a generation of performers and composers who made their debut at the Shiraz Arts Festival. The Western music and theatre, classic or avant-garde, and other ethnic performances in the festival left only little lasting impact. City of Tales. Theatre in particular became a conduit for an ambiguous message of dissident that was barely tolerable by the state's security in any other venue. As early as the latter half of the 19th century, modern theatre began to take roots in the Persian cultural environment, primarily as a means of educating the public and social awareness. Outside Iran, playwrights Fateli Akhundzadeh and Zain al-Abedin Marghehi produced plays critical of the decaying social mores, superstitions, and moral ills. The masterful verse rendering by Mirza Habib Isfahani, 1835-1893, of Molière's famous play Misanthrope, published in Istanbul in 1875 as Mardum Gariz, was a literary breakthrough, even though this play, and others produced abroad, only received a limited readership and was never staged for larger audiences. Nevertheless, like imaginary travel accounts, novellas, and other reform literature of the late 19th century, this body of early plays had some echo in the constitutional revolution's socio-cultural setting. From the mid-1920s on, theatre gained wider reception among the Iranian urban middle classes, especially in the capital. With the growth of leisure time, a number of modern playhouses were built in Tehran and in the provincial centres, and new theatrical troupes routinely performed, mostly adaptations of French plays. They met the entertainment needs of a secularizing intelligentsia, but also conformed to the Pahlavi modernizing project. The moralistic messages in plays such as those staged by Sayed Ali Nasr, 1891-1959, were unmistakable, stressing family values versus decrepitude and such ills as drinking and addiction, reason versus superstition, and, of course, patriotism and sacrifice for the fatherland. With some trepidation, women, first Russian emigres or Armenian and Assyrian semi-professional actors, appeared on the stage. Not unlike European 19th-century drama, themes of honour and shame received ample attention. There was even a touch of social naturalism. By the 1940s and early 1950s, the ascendancy of the left in Iranian artistic milieu also found its place in dramatic productions, often with a mild socio-political message. A number of talented Tudeh directors, actors, and actresses staged Western dramas distinct from the moralistic plays of earlier years. Yet original Persian plays of substance were seldom staged. One of the few in the 1950s was Sadek Hedayat's Mahalel, a temporary husband needed under Shi'i law to allow for a special kind of marriage annulment so that the original parties can resume their earlier union. It was a predictable commentary by a sharp critic of Islamic Sharia on the outdated practices of Shi'i law and its grip on Iranian society. The post-1953 climate of censorship and intimidation brought this interlude in Iranian theatre, thriving and hopeful though it was, to an abrupt end. Cinema, mostly Hollywood movies, and a growing number of movie theatres successfully competed with the stage, and by the early 1960s largely sapped the entertaining appeal of the theatre. A new lease on life for Persian theatre came in the late 1960s, this time voicing a more refined critique of the prevailing social order. Allegorical and increasingly in tune with the European committed theatre, as the theatre of the Jean-Paul Sartre era came to be known, and even with the theatre of absurd, it found a smaller but more engaged audience. Playwrights such as Gholam Hossein Saedi staged new productions in a playhouse built by the Pahlavi state and ironically named 25th of Shahrivar. Ironic, not only because the playhouse was built and named in honour of the Shah's coronation in 1967, but also in that it was patronised by Queen Farah, who called for a more open cultural space, at times at odds with the pressures of censorship and the Savak. Despite their innocuous surface, the new plays predominantly cast a sceptic, at times surrealistic, shadow on the boasted glories of the Pahlavi state and its white revolution, with subtle hints to the suffocating political climate. A remarkable example was the 1968 Shahr-e-Qesseh, City of Tales, by Bijan Mofid, 1935-1984, a musical play with rhymed prose that employed Persian animal fables and children folk tales to convey a semi-satirical commentary on the Pahlavi state, society, and identity. At home with the working-class culture of his home city, Tehran, Mofid used street lingo and popular proverbs along with Persian music to depict a richly allegorical tableau. Pantomime, animal masks, and a mix of satirical and sardonic dialogue created an ambiance of childlike innocence, but also mockery of the realities of modern Iran. The fabulous City of Tales resembles the City of Farang, Shahr-e Farang, a reference to the fast-changing face of the Iranian urban landscape and its artless mimicking of the West. The cast of characters, inhabitants of the city, included a crafty mullah in the guise of a fox, a lecherous fortune-teller in the guise of a bear, a sycophantic poet parrot, and a cynical intellectual in the guise of a monkey. While the first two satirized the clerical establishment and the folk religion of the poorer classes, the parrot hinted at the literary establishment and its adulation of the Pahlavi regime, and the monkey sneered at the intellectual's marginality. A luti, in the guise of a donkey, represented the working classes. By profession, he was a turner, a maker of wooden household implements, a craft that had been ruined by the invasion of plastics. In a moving monologue, unmasked, he shared with the audience his nostalgia for bygone times and the depth of alienation felt by ordinary Iranians. The elephant, another character from Persian children rhymes, was a curious newcomer to the glittering city. At the outset of the play, he slips and breaks his tusk. In pain, he appeals to the inhabitants for help, but unschooled in the complexities of the city, he receives nothing but mockery and tricks. In the end, he comes to a bitter realization that not only has he lost his tusks, the most precious symbol of his identity, but he also has morphed into a miserable composite, a mirror image of the ramshackle place that is the City of Tales. Welcomed by audiences, first at the Shiraz Arts Festival and later in the 25th Shahrivar Playhouse, Shahr-e Geseh was the longest-running play in the history of serious theatre in Iran. It succeeded in reaching wider audiences beyond the Tehran intelligentsia because its rhythmic narrative and the characters were entertaining without being banal, and its poignant message was not lost even on the non-elite. What Alleh Ahmad articulated in his Garb Zadegi, translated as West Toxication, some years earlier with a defiant tilt, here is conveyed by Mofid in a metaphorical language attuned to the Persian era. He nevertheless shared the disenchantment typical of the dissent culture of his generation. The play was a noted example of how the subtle messages of dissent were conveyed through theatre, cinema, and television to a wider audience, an inadvertent and possibly inevitable outcome of Pahlavi efforts to widen their popular appeal and co-opt actual or potential dissidents. The coded language of allegories and allusions went a long way, even through the state-controlled media, to increase cynicism toward the state and its privileged elite. New artistic departures. Aside from Mofid, only a handful of artistic personalities of the period were able to transcend political disenchantment that dominated the culture of the late Pahlavi era. Sohrab Sepehri, 1928-1980, whose minimalistic style of paintings and poetry offered a new mystical reading of nature, is one such exception. He was a poet of water, of trees and birds, of solitude and serenity, an artist in pain about a fast disappearing space that was about to be conquered by the forces of modernity. In the poem Water, from his 1967 collection Hajmeh Sabz, The Expanse of Green, he wrote, "Let us not muddy the water. Downstream, maybe a dove is drinking, or on the woods afar a finch preening its feathers, or in a hamlet an earthen jug is being filled to the brim. Let's not muddy the water. Perhaps the stream is on its way to a poplar tree to quench a heart heavy with sorrow. Perhaps a pauper has his hand immersed, dipping his stale bread. Upstream, people understand water. They did not muddy the water. We too should not." The simple imagery drew Sepehri's readers to his reflective space, a world detached from trivial realities of his surroundings. His deep interest in Buddhism no doubt shaped Sepehri's worldview and references in his poetry. Yet here too, references to breeze, dawn, and light, among others, can be read as elusive symbols calling for a moment of deliverance. Much of his appeal to the younger generation of Iranians lied not only in his poetic simplicity, but also in his desire to experience an authentic self. On a different plane, but with a similar urge to break the conventions of his time and seek artistic authenticity, was Parviz Tanavoli, born 1937, a sculptor known for his artistic perseverance stretching over 6 decades. Even more than Seperri, he moved away from the committed art of the 1960s to experiment with new concepts and media. As one of the founders of the Sago Khane, water fountain, artistic genre, Tanavoli sought in Shi'i popular symbols and rituals raw material for his abstract sculptures. His journey through mourning emblems and shrine symbolism, and his recasting of Farhad, the tragic hero of the Persian romance, as his artistic alter ego, eventually led him to an existential quest. A series of sculptures on the theme of nothingness conveys a seemingly perplexing message. One may see in his sculpting the word hiç, nothing, in numerous variants, a skeptical view of the cultural milieu within which he was operating. Similar to Seperri, Tanavoli's artistic message was novel insofar as it was free of ideology and distant from the prevailing discourse of political dissent. Yet the existential anxiety, along with aesthetic quality and masterful craftsmanship, proved lasting. His hiçes remained confident and uncompromised, as if in their glossy surface the words mirrored the transience of their surroundings. Popular culture and its icons. To complement social commentary, television also offered light entertainment and, significantly, Persian contemporary music, popular with audiences across class barriers. Perhaps the best-known diva was the gifted singer and actress Gugush Fayegeh Atashin, born 1950, who, since the late 1950s, had appeared first as a prodigy child entertainer and later as a successful pop singer. Her melodramatic voice complemented her melodramatic private life, which was followed by the press at every turn. A victim of the male-dominated entertainment industry, most of her successful songs bore sad melodies and gloomy lyrics. They narrated her personal story as much as the mood of her audiences, and with a growing touch of dissent. Her 1971 Geseye de Mahi, Tale of the Two Fish, recounts the tragic end of two fish in a murky sea, intimate and in love and oblivious to the perils ahead. When a kingfisher takes one fish, the other mourns the loss and waits for its own fatal end. This was evidently a reference to the young gorillas fighting and dying in the street battles against the security forces of the kingfisher. We nipped at big bubbles until a kingfisher killed my pair. Maybe he damned that wrecker of the nests. Now is my turn, its shadow cast over the water. After us, it'll be the turn of other pairs. Days are ahead for other hearts to be cruelly wrecked. No longer I wish to be a fish in the sea, but wish to endure in tales. The subliminal message of suffocation and despair came through with dramatic undertones in the songs of another well-known pop singer, Dariush Egbali, born 1951. His highly popular 1971 Buye Hashe Gandam, Fresh Scent of Wheat, with lyrics by Shahryar Ganbari and composed by the gifted Iranian-Armenian Varojan Hakhbandian, 1936-1977, voiced the fate of the dispossessed, who, having lost all their belongings to the powerful, only wished to preserve a patch of land on which they could survive. These are people, as the lyrics went, whose skin is the colour of the night. They are coming from the city of prayers with golden domes, and a longing for the scent of the wheat. The song calls on the people of power and affluence whose skin is made of velvet of the dawn. They are travellers from the city of Farang, and their goal is to build a forest of steel and skyscrapers. But what is the use of moaning the loss? So asks the song. The dispossessed, the blood in the veins of the land, will cry out this time, demanding not only the fresh scent of the wheat, but also their harvest and land. An obvious message of protest directed at the ruling elite. For me, the scent of the wheat, for you, whatever I have. For me, a patch of land, for you, whatever I reap. I am from this plague-ridden eastern clan. You are the glassy traveller of the land of Farang. My skin is of the colour of the night, yours of the red velvet. My wound is of blisters, your robe of leopard skin. You are thinking of forests of steel and skyscrapers. I think of a room big enough for you to rest. My body made of the soil, yours made of wheat stalks. Our bodies are thirstier than ever for a drop of water. Your land is the land of Farang, its people clad in embroidered silk. Mine is a city of prayer with golden domes. Your body is like an axe, mine a dying root. Carved on the tree trunk, a heart still throbs. Enough lamenting for the soil of my body. You are a passer-by. I am the blood in the veins of this land. My body doesn't wish to be injured in your hand, and I cry out loud, whether there is someone out there or not. For me, the scent of the fields. For me, whatever I have. For me, a patch of land. For me, whatever I reap. The lyrics not only alluded to the outcome of the land reform and fate of the displaced peasants, but also reflected the brooding public mood and dream of repossessing a lost cultural legacy. The familiar imagery of the night, code for all-embracing political suppression, had travelled from highbrow new poetry of the earlier years to popular songs, and with wider popular appeal. Most striking, though, was the reference to the city of prayers with golden domes. Like Farouk's messianic allusions in her later poems, here too the imagery had come out of purely secular milieu. The veiled call for a return to Islam and Shi'ism was reminiscent of Alleh Ahmad, and reclaiming the land for the dispossessed at the end of the song reflected the growing aspirations for revolt. Not surprisingly, the singer, the lyricist, and the composer ended up in Savak's brief detention. The most overtly activist, however, was Farhad Mehrad, 1944-2002, who voiced the same sense of despair, but with a more discernible revolutionary vigour. He too was detained by Savak. His 1971 Jom'eh, Friday, lyrics by Shahyar Ghanbari, and music by Esfandiyar Mon Faredzadeh, born 1941, the day of rest in the weekly calendar, represents not only the boredom often associated with Friday, but also doom and gloom. Mon Faredzadeh, a gifted composer, made this song as an implicit commemoration of the Siyakal incident. Through the soaking frame of my window, I see the picture of a bleak Friday. How dark is the black of her mourning dress. In her eyes I see black clouds thickening. Blood drips from those black, dark clouds. Friday's blood comes down instead of raindrops. Friday's age is nearly 1,000 years. On Friday's grief takes its toll. Bored with oneself, one cries out with the mouth shut. Friday is the time for departure, the season for breaking away. But he who is my fellow traveller stabbed a dagger in my back. Black, siyah, is a clear wordplay with the word siyakal, with mourning and blood allusions to how the incident went awry and collapsed into disaster. Stabbing in the back, a reference to betrayal by a fellow guerrilla fighter, perfected the modern martyrdom narrative bemoaned by a generation of sympathisers. The siyakal genre, as it came to be known, was plain and accessible, with a message effectively released through record singles, then popular with middle-class youth. It romanticised for a generation an armed revolt that idealised revolution as the only way ahead. During the 1,000-year-old barren Fridays of repression, as Farhad reminded his audience, one can only cry out with mouth shut, a paradox of silent protest that defined the spirit of the age. Film Farsi and Reclaiming Injured Honour. In the same vein, though at a lower register and emitting a subversive message at a slower pace, the Iranian popular film industry in the 1960s and 1970s churned out a huge number of low-rate productions, essentially for the working-class market and provincial tastes. Despite the primarily entertaining function of these movies, some carried a message of social injustice and class divisions. They were labelled by highbrow film critics as hodgepodge stew films, in reference to the frequent portrayals of a poor family eking out a difficult but honourable existence, often symbolised by gathering around a bowl of Persian stew, abkusht. Starting in the late 1930s, Iranian popular cinema labelled film Farsi, like their Indian and Egyptian counterparts, often follow a simple plot. A righteous man of meagre means, though seldom a woman, from a poor urban or village background, who, having been exposed to the temptations of large city, money, sex, and bad company, sinks low into a dangerous or hapless lifestyle. He is saved only by a moral awakening of some sort that leads to a happy ending, often in the form of union with a chaste woman. Scenes of singing and dancing, often in a low-brow nightclub, were associated with the evils of drinking and inevitable cafe fights, borrowed from Western saloons. The reformed hero, in contrast, upholds virtues of sacrifice, generosity, care for his parents, and, of course, manly honour. Though the affluent classes were not always demonised, there were plenty of villainous capitalists, land speculators, and money-grabbers. With captivated viewers who packed movie theatres throughout the country, film Farsi competed with foreign imports, both Hollywood and Indian productions, in offering entertainment and moral messages customised for Iranian popular tastes. Such films as Ganje Garun, Garun's Treasure, 1965, and Sultan-e-Kalbha, King of Hearts, 1968, starred Muhammad Ali Fardin, 1931-2000, a freestyle wrestling Olympic silver medalist who became a movie star. Dashing and athletic, his lead character often championed the cause of the poor and deprived, lived modestly but honourably, and upheld the bonds of friendship while remaining cheerful, adventurous, and entertaining. This was all in the garb of a down-and-out modern luti, who was always ready for a good fight. Fardin's physique, singing, dancing, and rascality that made him appealing in the film to rich and beautiful girls and opened the doors of privilege and wealth, nevertheless could not divert the hero from his modest roots, a message particularly congenial to his viewers, who held the affable hero as one of their own. In the best-known song in the 1965 Ganje Garun, dubbed by Iraj, Hossein Khwaje Amiri, born 1933, a professional singer of luti intonation, the penniless hero renounces the legendary treasure of Garun, originally the biblical Quranic Korah, along with other symbols of affluence and power, in favour of a frugal but tranquil existence. As he sings, life is too short and not worth the trouble of amassing wealth, a message long embedded in the luti ethos. At the end, however, once the hero has defeated the rich villains, thanks to his chivalry, congeniality, and street smarts, he not only gets the girl, but also the riches of Mr. Garun, his own repentant father. More than just a predictable cliché, presumably the creation of Ahmad Shamlou, the happy ending reflected something of the aspirations of the working people, who were hoping to preserve values of modesty and honour, while amicably sharing with the affluent their prosperity and pleasure. In 1965, more than 2 million viewers saw the movie, and it brought in more than 53 million rial, about $7.5 million, remarkable numbers for any screening in Iranian film history. In the 1969 drama Qaisar, meaning Caesar in Arabic and Persian, directed by Masoud Kimiai, the theme of working-class morality took a very different turn. With a more professional directorship and sophisticated plot, the motivating force in the story is not a happy ending, but vengeance for soiled family honour. The central character is not a rascal, but an angry luti in modern guise, furious but committed to his chivalrous code of conduct. He has been left with no choice but to resort to violence against vicious enemies who dishonoured his sister and killed his older brother. The fateful struggle ends with the family honour restored, not only by the spilling of the blood of the villains, but also by the hero's tragic end. The highly successful film, a hybrid of popular and artistic genres, did not employ singing and dancing or resort to a happy ending, as if reflecting a changing mood among its viewers. As later films by the same director made more explicit, Qaisar was a call to traditional values closely intertwined with religious symbolism. To save society from the onslaughts of its villains, there should be blood sacrifices, a message that not unsubtly denounced the Pahlavi vision of modernity and anticipated violence ahead. A less idealized image of the changing code of chivalry than what was portrayed in Qaisar appeared in Dariush Merjui's 1975 Dayerehe Mina, Enameled Circle, Cycle in its English release, a piercing critique of the health profession in Iran, written by the foremost playwright of the time, Gholam Hossein Saedi. A psychiatrist by profession, Saedi had long explored in his plays and short stories a subversive and yet surreal Beckett-like world of the Iranian underclasses, haunted villages, forgotten fishing communities, pimps and old prostitutes, beggars. A prolific writer, his Tudeh activism of the earlier years was transformed in the 1960s and early 1970s into an imaginative, at times disturbing body of literary works with covert symbolism. The horrific world of the professional bloodseller is one such setting. The film is a study of mostly poor drug addicts in the neighborhoods of southern Tehran who sold blood for a living and the mafia-like network that monopolized the trade. This is the world of Ali, a teenager coming of age in a big city. His metamorphosis turns him from an innocuous émigré into a ruthless agent of tainted blood, an anti-hero who, in the process, sells himself out, abandons his fatally ill father, and loses all his virtues in the ruthless pursuit of money and pleasure. The naked symbolism of the blood network, a commentary no doubt on the cruel forces that had infected Iranian society, especially its youth, was too naked to be missed. It was banned at the outset when the Iranian Medical Association protested the film's portrayal of hospital administration, and later by censors who found it to be a negative portrayal of Iranian society.